Before we get started with today's show, I wanted to tell you about another great ESPN podcast. The Mina Kimes Show featuring Lenny is a podcast that brings you the latest news and trends in and around the NFL. Join Mina and her guests such as NFL analyst Dominique Foxworth, insider and fantasy football focus host Field Yates, and ESPN Radio's Mike Golic Jr. If you like X's and O's, analytics, and probably too much dog talk, Lenny is a dog, then give the Mina Kimes Show featuring Lenny a listen wherever you get your podcasts. Also, NBA Today, hosted by Malika Andrews, offers exclusive content Monday through Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific. Alongside Malika, there will be a full cast of NBA experts and insiders, including Kendrick Perkins, Chinne Agumake, Vince Carter, Zach Lowe, Adrian Wojnarowski, Ramona Shelburne, and many of our NBA reporters from around the league. Get caught up with the latest from around the NBA on NBA Today on ESPN and the ESPN app. One app, one tap. And also available as a podcast. Listen to NBA Today wherever you get your podcasts. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. We've got guests joining us this week. Eric Dickerson will join us on the back end, but on the front end, coming to us live, repping Channel 6, best college football writer in America, Spencer Hall. What's going on?
Oh, nothing much. Just enjoying the Stetson Bennett essence with the rest of you.
Dude, I was just about to say, you are in Atlanta, and I guess we ain't really going outside too much, but still, it was so wild for me watching that game and the whole broadcast team trying to make this about Stetson Bennett, right? Like, that decision has been made. We are going to make this into the underdog story about Stetson Bennett. And don't get me wrong, he made that big throw on that free play, which is the best throw of his life. Like, that's his David Tyree moment. I'll never do anything that incredible again. And I heard Feinbaum say this on TV. Was it Feinbaum? I think it was. Like, the old joke, you know, you'll never have to buy another drink in this town. Oh, it's way past a drink for Stetson Bennett. I don't think he'll ever have to buy a house in the state of Georgia.
No. And, you know, they made it about him, and I understand, because that's a very clear moment. Remember, football's confusing. It's easy to focus on the dude with the ball. That is the easiest thing you could do in football, is to say, hey, the dude with the ball made all of this happen. He made one thing happen. He was good after that fumble. He was 4 for 4 after the fumble, which could have completely sunk him. I think he is, more than anything, still underrated, and this is why. And I was thinking about this morning. I was like, well, what am I going to say about Stetson Bennett that hasn't been said already? And I will say this. The strength of that team is the Georgia defense. Who does Stetson Bennett practice against every single day? He practices against the Georgia defense, and he's not dead. He's 5'0". He's like 168 pounds, I'm guessing, 165 if you put a couple of biscuits on him. And he rose from the scout team to starter. That, to me, is more impressive than anything he did all year based on what I saw the defense do. That is the most impressive thing about Stetson Bennett, is that he managed to do this homegrown against that defense, which, to my mind, is the best of all time, just top to bottom. Like, if you just had to, you know, pick a card, right? I might take them. In fact, I probably would take them over the 2001 Canes, the 2000-2001 Canes around there. I'd take them over the black shirts just because I think the level of athleticism and intelligence across the board and, like, what they do culturally is so far over anything that they do.
08 USC is the sneaky one for me when we get into this discussion. Like, that's the one where you go back and look at it and you're like, oh, they didn't let anybody score.
No, they didn't like it when you did that. And they were very adamant about that on a physical plane, on a physical level. And they had very mean people. That's the other thing about that 08 USC defense. I know people are looking at a Pac-12 defense and going, no, you got to understand. Pete Carroll, when he went full heel in the NFL and just decided that offense sucks after relying on it, this was the germ of that, was that 08 USC team where he was like, no, I like this. I like not even having to worry about scoring if I just destroy the other team on offense.
Yeah, I got like 4 or 5-star running backs. Like, that was the thing. He just had running back after running back, none of whom actually turned out to be worth a damn, but it was just running back after running back after running back. We're just going to roll those out here. Now, let me ask you this about Stetson Bennett, because I contend this may be the worst thing to ever happen to Georgia. Like, the national championship, obviously, best thing. But I have been saying all year long, you don't go with the low-ceiling quarterback. You're not going to win a championship playing the low-ceiling quarterback. And it almost got him in the SEC championship. And to be honest, it almost got him in the first half of the championship game when Stetson Bennett was out there looking shook. Like, the wildest thing about it is he was shook, got unshook, blew it, and then got unshook again, right? Mm-hmm. That shocked me. But this means Kirby's going to be out here rolling out mediocre quarterbacks for you guys from here on out because he now believes you can do that.
It's maybe long-term, yeah, a terrible thing. This may be a Faustian bargain. This may be selling your soul to a very particular devil because I don't really understand. Like, the lesson to me is that Georgia should have won two national titles by this point, right? They should have won this one, which they did, and then they should have beaten Alabama in the Tua game. That should have happened. And the reason they didn't in the first one is they started the low-ceiling quarterback. That's really the thing. The quarterback who, by the way, as of 3 days ago, 4 days ago, was running a sneak on 3rd and 9, which was only made funnier by the fact that the Giants ran a sneak on 2nd and 10 prior to that. So with the same dude, Jake Fromm. And that's no slight to any quarterback put in this position. It's the choice that you're indicting here. You're saying, hey, I don't really think, you know, this isn't the dude to do it. And now they're not going to learn that lesson, are they? They're not. They're going to start this guy over again. I think that also underestimates another thing on this, by the way. You say the low-ceiling quarterback. Stetson Bennett's good. Like, that's, we were not debating that, right? Like, he's a good quarterback. He's a good He's good. That's a good college quarterback. The idea that you're going to be able to make do with good, it's not like Bryce Young lost this game because of anything that was in his control. He lost his two best receivers and then faced the greatest defense of all time. And he was still pretty good. Like, he was, like, if you look at it, he made some gigantic mistakes in that game. He made gigantic mistakes because he's playing a team whose defense was, again, generationally talented and capable of executing whatever they wanted against an offense that could not present a threat. And everyone's going to take the wrong lessons from this, including Kirby. I think a lot of the time, maybe that's where they won't make accommodations. We have to bend over backwards for recruits all the time and say, well, you'll get this or you'll get that. I still think, if you scratch the surface, that Kirby Smart is at root, like a Georgia meathead who really just wants to win 10-3. I just think that's in his DNA. I just think he's that kind of defensive coach. And I don't think that's what the game is.
Yeah. Bennett, good. He is a middle-class version of, like, the Colt McCoy archetype, right? Like that's the thing about it, is that a dude like Colt McCoy, as a freshman, is like, I don't know, I think we went with the low-ceiling guy, and then you realize, oh my goodness, his ceiling is actually rather high. This is a bit surprising where this thing ultimately goes. Like, Bennett isn't in that class, I don't think. But, no, he was better than I expected him to be out there. It's just that this is one of those teams where I feel bad for him, is that they're so broadly loaded that the only name that anybody's going to remember, they'll remember Jordan Davis because he's the most giant man in the world, and then it's going to be Stetson Bennett, and we're not going to talk about anything else. Dalvin Cook's brother plays for that team, and you may not even know that he was Dalvin Cook's brother. He was a 5-star, too, and really, really, really good, just so you know. He just washes away. It's like Stetson Bennett going to be the Herschel Walker of this team, where that 1980 Herschel team, other than Lindsey Scott, and just because run Lindsey, the Larry Munson call, it's Herschel Walker and a bunch of dudes. And except this team is way better than that one was.
Yeah, and that may be colored, I think, by how everyone does in the NFL. Because guess what? A lot of people going to the league from this team. A lot of people. N'Kobe Dean is, I've said this repeatedly, he's my favorite linebacker I've seen in a long time. I don't remember enjoying watching linebacker play quite like you watch N'Kobe Dean, because the dude can run hash to hash in the blink of an eye. It's terrifying. It doesn't really matter if the guy who's on the slot receiver doesn't make the play. N'Kobe Dean will make it for him. That's how good he is. And he's the kind of player who can overcome bad coaching, and he doesn't get bad coaching. That's how good he was at the college level. I'm sure in the NFL he will receive crap coaching and ignore it. That will happen at one point. It's inevitable because they keep recycling the same dudes. And at mid-level, he's going to get somebody in charge of that defense who has no idea what they're doing. And it won't matter because N'Kobe Dean is that great at the position and that talented and that smart. I got lost talking about N'Kobe Dean. Point being, we're going to see the legacy of this team, not just now, but like later on when we see how many of these guys do well in the league. And maybe Georgia partisans will remember Stetson Bennett better, but I think there are still defensive guys on the staff, and maybe a couple offensive ones. I think Brock Bowers, we have to deal with him for a couple of more years. I'm not really looking forward to that from a partisan perspective, because he's nasty.
That's dude. A tight end, right?
Yeah, that's the big old refrigerator of a tight end who runs like a 4-1, as far as I can tell, if I had to clock him.
And yo, it's like, he's important. Because apparently there is a state law. We've talked about this many times. I don't know where it's written down, but somebody's going to pull it out, that it is required by the laws of the state of Georgia that you can't run a pass pattern without a white man in it. Either a white man going to be throwing it. In fact, it seems like a white man throwing it and catching it. But there will always be. It's just they haven't produced like that cold white dude catching passes. Oh, till now. Till now. Him and the homie McConkey, who appears to be very, very speedy.
Lad. L-A-D-D, in case you wanted. Like, I like that they were going to name him Lad. And they're like, nah, that's too close to the word Lad. And they're like, just throw on an extra D. That's fine. Everybody will get it. Yeah, Lad McConkey and Brock Bowers. Passes from Stetson Bennett. We're going to get a lot of the wrong ideas at the high school level based on these results, not understanding how exceptional these dudes are. We're going to get a lot of torn ACLs for youth prospects who believe they're a 4'6", when in fact they are a 5'7".
Yo, by the way. Gabe Bassain with the important information. Bowers is from his neck of the woods, Napa.
Napa, that is correct. As I said in one of our posts this week, he is like a Chardonnay in that he has an oaky finish because hitting him is like hitting a tree, and he's got buttery hands. So, yeah, they had to go all the way to Napa to find a really Georgia-type player.
I told you, though, this is important, right? Because the stakes are too high now to uphold that state law, just whatever white dude you can find, right? And if you're going to find fast white dudes, you have to go places that don't have black people. I don't understand why this is, but you think about all like the super duper fast white dudes. They're all from places with no black people, right? Think about Cooper Kupp. Adam Thielen.
Tim Dwight.
Yep, Tim Dwight. Do you remember a gentleman by the name of Don Beebe? Mm-hmm. He was from North Dakota. We talking about this cat right here, Jordy Nelson, Manhattan, Kansas own. You got to have nothing but white people in the ecosystem for people to build up your self-esteem properly to lead you to believe that you can, in fact, achieve these. Look, it's kind of like how most black PhDs come from HBCUs. You don't get all that negative talk in the presence of these other people. The people will allow you possibly to self-actualize. I don't know. I mean, really, run up and down. It don't make no sense that the only good football players that are fast, that are white, are not from the South. They just don't add up.
You're saying there's just some dude in lacrosse gear somewhere who has like a 4.38 inside him, never got to do it because he was running up against like some future LSU recruit.
Dude, he didn't even run up on him. He went to the football coach and was like, I want to play wide receiver. And they were like, you want to play lacrosse? He's like, nah, but for real, like, I can go. Like, I got, nah, yeah, okay. We got a sport that we think you'll enjoy a little bit more. And then they just send him out of there. Just like when a black dude goes to play lacrosse and he gets out there and he's super fast. And they're like, son, can you catch?
Let me play another angle on this thought experiment. Stetson Bennett just squandered one of the greatest potential lacrosse careers in NCAA history. Because if he's that good at quarterback, he'd be unreal on, like, the Johns Hopkins or Princeton lacrosse team.
Yes. Well, my favorite thing about Stetson Bennett was they came and did that post-game interview with him on the field. We are playing up underdog, right? Nobody thought that you were going to get here, da-da-da. How does that feel? And Stetson Bennett is going one step beyond that. He's like, you didn't think I was going to be able to play for Georgia. I think I'm the best quarterback. Period. he thinks he's better than Bryce Young. He thinks he's better than anybody else that you could roll out there, which I have to say kind of takes a little bit of the edge off the I'm just so glad to be here. He is not. He thinks he should have won the Heisman Trophy.
That's pure wrestling, by the way. That's absolute pure wrestling. That is like when you knock out the champ when they're not looking with a folding chair. And then turn around and be like, I'm the greatest. I did it. Like, that's a full heel turn, right? That is Ken Shamrock getting knocked out with a plate. And the guy turning around and being like, I did it myself. I did it all myself, 100%. Homegrown. Grind. That's what it is. Like, I adore that. By the way, this too. Stetson Bennett said, you know, when they were trying to set up the underdog angle, they're like, nobody believed in you. Now, this is a point. Can't see what I'm doing with the camera, but I'm pointing in you specifically, pointing at Stetson Bennett, because there are a bunch of other fingers pointing at the mutants on the other side of the ball and the huge men on the line and your gigantic skill players. They're like, we believed in them. We 100%. Like, it is the most damning storyline when you look at the rest of Georgia to go, hey, man, nobody believed in Stetson Bennett, because there are 21 other people on the field who are all 4 and 5 stars and incredible at what they do. And we're like, that's so demeaning. I don't blame him for immediately going, no, man, I thought I should have been here. And to my point, that man played all of this and proved all of this mostly against his own defense in practice. Mostly. And I know they tried to kill him. I know they tried to dismember that man. Right? Like, think about it. That man went up against Jordan Davis in practice. He went up against N'Kobe Dean in practice. What's going to scare you after that? Go ahead. Talk your shit. Do it.
Because I assure you, none of those guys on that defense hang out with Stetson Bennett. I feel very, very confident. Like, he ain't got that buddy. I'm actually surprised that we didn't hear all through the broadcast about he and either Bowers or McConkey being roommates. Because you know how that goes, right? The Colt McCoy, Jordan Shipp, you're like, who are you guys going to kick? Oh, I think you guys should room with each other. Okay, it's a vestige of the 1960s and 70s. That struck me. Let me tell you what else got me. You want to see my impression of Georgia backup quarterback JT Daniels, former five-star recruit?
Mm-hmm.
I could have done that.
He could have done that. He could have done that very easily.
He just lost so much money. All he had to do was be the quarterback of this team, leave, and go be a first-round pick.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or, as our colleague Joel Anderson has brought up, Jamie Newman. Jamie Newman. Remember? Greatest Georgia quarterback ever. My favorite, because he never played a single game for the Georgia Bulldogs before sitting out, opting for the NFL draft, and falling to, I believe, undrafted.
Yes. I mean, he made the early call, and it was an understandable and reasonable call at the time. I'm sitting out because of COVID, right? Mm-hmm. Like, when he did it, it was like, wow, you're getting ahead of this thing here, right? Okay, there we go. And we'll never know if it was like a truly bad decision, because we don't know what was or was not going on with a lot of these teams about testing and everything else. But that dude has been forgotten completely. He might as well stay at Wake Forest.
You know who else has been forgotten? We haven't even mentioned the running gag about Kirby that nobody will mention until, I imagine, this happens next year again. We haven't mentioned Justin Fields. We haven't mentioned Brock Vandegrift. We haven't mentioned a bunch of different people who are either still on the depth chart, right? There are your obvious walk-on quarterbacks in there. Jackson Muschamp, Will Muschamp's son, got a ring off this. Jackson Muschamp, in case you wondered if he was ever going to see the field in the national title game, the answer is no. He was very far down on the depth chart. There are those guys, but there are 4 and 5 stars on that depth chart who just don't seem to get up there. And the question is that because they have a certain profile at quarterback that they like in terms of being risk averse, in terms of keeping the ball close and not turning it over and taking very few chances offensively in order to not screw up the defense, which evidently, hey, today on January 12th, 2022, we're both wrong, they're right, because Georgia has a title this year, but right is a conditional thing, and it varies by the calendar year, and more often toward the offense, I would point out. At this point, is that the reason that we keep seeing 4 and 5-star talent ride the bench in Athens? Like, why does that keep happening? As a QB recruit, I know this is what we're talking about, this game. This is all an exhibition. Kirby said that we're 11 days behind everybody else on starting the year. That means we're a recruiting operation that sometimes stages football games. How do you go to a QB and say, come here? Like, if you're a 4 or 5-star, and we're at 99s across the board in terms of comparing, like, Bama's a 99 when it comes to possibility, Georgia's a 98. And that point there is, am I going to get beat out by a Stetson Bennett? Because they just don't want to try offensively, right?
They got another 5-star coming in this year, right?
Oh, yeah. The name escapes me, but, like, they keep recruiting 4 and 5-star QBs. That's not the issue. It's not that Kirby can't recruit a quarterback. They just keep ending up with Jake Fromm and Stetson Bennett. And the question is, for both QB prospects and anyone watching, is why? And now, to your point earlier, maybe this just got worse for them, right? And by the way, worse is relative. We're talking about a very padded, luxurious worse. We're talking about gout. We're talking about an illness of wealth, because this is a very wealthy and successful football program right now that just got their first ring since 1980 and who will not be out of the top five for the next 5 years. Like, preseason wise, you're not going to see Georgia out of the top five. It's just not going to happen with what they've got going on and how much talent they've got on that roster and how committed they are. But at the margins, that's got to worry you a little bit. There are no worries for Georgia right now. But down the road, you got to go, okay, if I got to put a little bit of a lead lining on this particularly beautiful cloud, that would be the thing I'd worry about.
Okay, so as we're here, I'm on the wiki page, and I'm looking at Georgia's list of coordinators / assistant coaches.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, this has got to be at least 25 people. It is a fascinating mix of what you want to have or what you will have on your coaching staff in the South. When I say that, I'm like, okay, well, first of all, you're going to have a guy with a name like Buster, a guy named Neyland, N-E-Y-L-A-N-D, because of course someone would name their child after Robert Neyland. We have one of those here on the staff. We have a dude who is a combination of two things you have to have on your coaching staff in the South here. One, his name is Montgomery. And two, his last name is Van Gorder because, of course, nepotism.
Yes.
Right? Like the nepotism here is present. You have your former players and obligatory Afro-Americans, Jonas Jennings, ATL's own former offensive lineman at Georgia. He's there. You got your cast-offs from other programs, Matt Luke and Will Muschamp. And I just didn't tell you about like 25 people. They have so many people on this staff. This is bananas.
Yeah, and this is the pattern you've seen. If people want to know, like, what are these people doing and why are there so many people on staff? It's because Nick Saban set the model for this. Overcommit and overutilize your resources. Just stuff people in every single nook and cranny of your organization so that you don't miss anything. Over-report, over-scout, over-recruit. Like, and I say over, the results speak for themselves. It's not really over-commitment if you keep getting the results you want. But if you were a company and you saw this many people on the payroll to all do the same job, you'd get out the scissors. You'd start making some cuts. All right? It's a deeply inefficient business. It really is. Like, in terms of the number of contacts that people have to make with a single recruit, in terms of the number of positive reports, like your scouts and your recruiting evaluators, your talent people have to come back multiple times to say, you should take a look at this dude. There is no more sitting in a film room and going, well, I guess we should take that guy. No. That doesn't happen anymore. You don't recruit somebody off that. Not that it ever really happened anyway. But now it is this layered bureaucratic process that requires so many people and so many coaches and so many people with names that used to belong to coaches you worked with whose kids you've now put on staff. And in the end, you know, it works, but like, after a while, you just go, man, you're building these gigantic organizations and you have these big offices and you have these facilities that... Have you seen Georgia's new facility, by the way? Have you seen? Oh, palatial. Like it is essentially a museum to Georgia football and football facility and training center all built into one thing with sheet glass, right? It's got like your beautiful postmodern sheet glass on the side and, you know, Georgia logos everywhere and a full nutrition center that makes sure that everybody gets 150 grams of protein a day. It's nuts. It's nuts. It is all a glaring edifice that keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger and harder to hide when it comes to when you're going to pay the players. Like, when are you going to pay? When are you going to pay these people? Because evidently, we can pay 30 other people. We can pay 60 other people. We can do what Billy Napier's doing in Florida, which is the Saban model. And I'm a Florida fan. You've been watching, and they say, "Well, we hired this guy." And you look at the title, and you go, "I don't know what that means." Right? Associate talent recruiter, high school level associate evaluate. Like, so many people getting hired under so many different titles, where ultimately you go, "Hey, this sounds a lot like a business. This sounds a lot like a corporation."
But it's interesting, my man Alan Kinney makes this point. Mm-hmm. The thing that makes college football so backward is that the stakeholders and the shareholders are two different people, right? And so this is an inefficient business because the people who are contributing money to it aren't looking to make a profit, right? So they can go out with the hat in hand to be like, hey, we need to hire a couple more guys to watch film. We were thinking that maybe we could get Phil Fulmer, right? You know, like somebody of that level, and then somebody will write the check. And you're like, yo, this doesn't make any sense. But those people aren't, the only payoff they're looking for is wins. It's not actual money. And so you have all these people who will just pump all this money into this so that Will Muschamp's son, Robert, or brother, I guess I was assuming son because it says quality control. But anyway, he's on the Georgia staff too.
Yeah, and we get everybody, we have so many quality control guys, and we've also diversified that role, by the way, that we've not only built up these gigantic staffs where there are people who aren't coaches who are actually coaching things, we've managed to turn it into a professional mentoring and rehab center for coaches so that we actually cut off lanes for new talent, right? Particularly, I think, when you go at the margins, you know, well, why aren't there more, you know, why aren't there more, you know, assistants of color? Why don't we have more, you know, particularly African-American assistants coming up? Because that's the real, like, you go, okay, well, why don't we have more black head coaches? Well, we don't have more black head coaches because there aren't more assistant coaches. Well, where do those assistants come from? Well, you know, they can get recycled a lot. And when we expand these staffs and we say, hey, you just got fired, why don't you come be a quality control person? Those hires are just as important now, because if you go do quality control for Nick Saban for a while, then you probably end up with a job somewhere, right? Even Butch Jones got a job out of that, right? He got another head coaching
gig.
Yeah. I believe that's Arkansas State, who had, don't look at their record. Don't. It went fine. It's great. It's going great. Don't check how many wins they've got. But if you keep hiring guys who recently got fired for that, that's just another feedback loop preventing new talent from entering the system. You know, that's the one side effect of that. Like, it is funny that, you know, Joe Judge got fired at the Giants, and it's like, okay, well, that's a Nick Saban assistant. Let's just do what he's going to go hire him, because he's got an entire staff full of assistant head coaches. Nick has done a decent job on diversity, but like that kind of behavior, that kind of like loop within an organization is just going to feed and exacerbate a lot of the ongoing problems this sport has in terms of HR.
Yeah. And if you're worried about poor Nick Saban, nope, his two best players are coming back next year. At least we presume that they are going to come back next year. And this is going to shock you, but every way too early preseason top 25 from next year, Georgia, Alabama, Ohio State. This ain't about the SEC. This is about three programs that are blowing. Oh, and Texas A&M at number four, because they have now got their player getting money machine up to a place where now they are there. That's going to be it. But hey, college football, that Spencer Hall, check him out. Channel 6. I recommend you subscribe. I subscribe. It's very good. Absolutely worth your time. Greatly appreciate it, sir.
Thank you, sir. Oh, one more thing, by the way. Let me share with you that 2023 recruit we do have for the University of Georgia, a gigantic white tight end, 6'6". His name, Pierce Sperlin.
He's local too, isn't he?
Santa Rosa Beach, Florida. That's where I go for 2 weeks a year and get my Salt Life sticker and put it on a truck.
Learn something new every day. I'll talk to you soon, man.
All right.
All right, so our next guest, I have to say, I know so many people who I don't know if they're actually related to our next guest, but they all say they're related to our next guest because they're all from Sealy, Texas. He is one of the greatest running backs of all time, and his new book is coming out, Watch My Smoke, a look back at his life and career. Eric Dickerson, how are you, man?
Good morning. How you doing?
Dude, my mother, when I was growing up, worked at Prairie View, and so we have a lot of people around there who worked in, you know, lived in Sealy and worked out there, and you just couldn't tell exactly how related to you they were, but everybody had some halfway connection that all goes right back to Eric Dickerson.
That's funny, because Sealy's only about 30 miles from Prairie View, and my real dad, he went to Prairie View University, so I have a lot of people in that area. And I'm from Texas, so it could have been. You know how it is. Oh, that's my cousin's cousin.
No, it's like with people from Macon, Georgia, everybody related to Otis Redding, right? Like, some of them related to Little Richard, but they don't say that as loud, but they all related to Otis Redding, and if not, their grandmama taught them or something like that because it ain't been so big.
I got you.
Yeah, man. So the book, Watch My Smoke, it's so much going on there. You seem to be talking about a lot and a level of candor that I think may surprise some people in doing this. So why was now the time for you to write this book?
Well, you know, I talked about it for a couple of years, and a good friend of mine, Gustavo Miguel, is the one who kind of got me to write the book. You know, tell some of my stories to him and other people, and all of them would say, man, just write a book, man. You know what I mean? People don't even know this. I didn't even know it. So it just came down to a point where I'm older now, so time is running out. I'm going forwards, but not going backwards. I just feel like that it was time to do it.
This is the time you answer the question of where the Trans Am came from. And I feel like the answer might be a little anticlimactic for people.
Exactly. I mean, people always thought, you know, that the school bought the Trans Am. We sneak, you know, that snuck it off, and, you know, and but it wasn't like that, you know, like in the book, it'll tell you exactly how the Trans Am was purchased. And they always say, you know, you got all this money from SMU. It wasn't like that either. It wasn't like that at all.
Well, I feel like my question is, why didn't they buy you a Trans Am? Like my thought, whenever the thing comes up with the Trans Am, I have less questions about like whether or not somebody bought, if they did not buy it for you, it seems pretty clear that somebody should have.
Well, the Trans Am, you know, it was bought, you know, and my grandmother basically got the money back. And so it kind of, in a sense, it was purchased, you know, it cost us, but it didn't cost us. So it was like a good, I said it was a good deal. Man, I was so happy with that car. I got to tell you, I just, when I first saw it, I'm like, man, I just loved everything about it. The gold eagle, I mean, the gold eagle on the hood, T-tops. I mean, that was the car back then.
I mean, what was it like for you the first time you pulled into the parking lot at school with that?
Oh, man, come on now. You know, that wasn't too popular. You know, it was popular with some kids, but not popular with other kids. It was a big investigation right away as soon as I showed up with the car. Because, see, everyone thinks that when I say my grandmother, like the lady who raised me, my great-great-aunt, that's not my grandmother. My grandmother lived in Houston with my grandfather. And the thing is, like, see, they could afford the car. They pretty much got a new car every couple of years because my grandfather's a crane operator. And, you know, like I said, they could not disprove it.
Those are the wild days of the Southwest Conference, though, right? Do you go to SMU, which is Highland Park in Dallas, is a totally different world than where you grew up. Like, not all Texas is the same. And now you're in the world of, like, the oil money, right? And this is a completely different class of people than the people that you were dealing with prior to that. And they're throwing money around because they want to be really good at football. And I'm just trying to imagine what the scene had to be like for you showing up there.
Well, you know, SMU is like a lot of schools in Southeastern. We were a smaller school, but, you know, the thing is, I think it really came down to the alumni. The alumni like to brag about, you know, we beat y'all and you beat us. And we got this guy, you know, you can get this guy. You know, you hear that about that later. That was the big thing back in those days. And really, like you said, I came from a small town in Sealy, Texas, a country town, going to Highland Park, you know, where they got the big mansions. It was almost like the Beverly Hillbillies. You know, first thing you know, Jay's a millionaire. So it was a different world for me. But, you know, the thing is that a lot of guys on the team had cars. You know, it wasn't anything that was foreign. I mean, our parking lot, you had the 280ZX, the Trans Am. Craig had a 944 Porsche. Pretty much every starter had a car.
You know, one thing I think about with you, and like, I remember when the 30 for 30 came out, Pony Access, about the time at SMU when they would show clips of you in college. And that for me was like the first time that I had seen you like just talking and doing interviews at that time. And I compared it to like a guy like Derek Jeter or Clyde Frazier, where it fascinates me about those dudes. Like Clyde Frazier's from Atlanta and went to Southern Illinois. But when he got to New York City, he was already up to speed on what life was in New York City. Like he was ready to be a star. And like Derek Jeter was ready to be a star. You were ready to be a star the second you got to SMU, it looked like.
Well, you know, maybe outwardly I was, but inwardly I was still a country kid, you know, from a small town. Because, you know, we were right close to Houston, Texas, and I was in Houston all the time. You know, in Houston and Dallas, it's only 240 miles away from each other. So, like I said, in a sense I was, but in a way I wasn't, because I wasn't used to all the stuff that was there, like, you know, like seeing the big houses, the big really mansions, you know, right there in Highland Park. You know, and that school, SMU, was predominantly white. I mean, in my town was pretty much white, but mostly black. You know, you kind of knew everyone. And being on a campus that was, to me, it was ginormous, but it wasn't that big, you know, believe it or not. But, you know, it was my first time in college from a small high school that in my high school, I had 50 people in my graduating class. So it was some culture shocks in some ways. In some ways, it was not.
I think one of the interesting things about that is you and Craig James came in together, and this was at a time where, honestly, like the idea of good white football players, especially playing running back, wasn't as foreign as I think it seems to a lot of people now. But your freshman year, you know, according to a lot of reports, Craig James had a better freshman season than you did at SMU. And what was that like for you? Because I imagine that you thought you were going to get there and just run the whole conference.
Yeah, I mean, the thing was, me and Craig were friends. We became really good friends. And, you know, I didn't hold anything against Craig. It was just, I wasn't ready for college football. I thought I was. I tell a lot of these young kids when they go to college the first year, I say, you think you're ready to play right away? Oh, yeah, I'm ready to start. I said, they tell you that. I said, but 9 times out of 10, you're not ready to start because your body's not developed enough. And mine wasn't. And Craig came from a real weight program at a Stratford High School. And I didn't. I mean, I was really a track guy that played football. And so after a while, my body caught up. I caught up. I had quite a few injuries my first year. You know, I had a thigh injury, a hamstring injury, ankle injury, shoulder injury, just one after another my freshman year. Then, you know, I think the most hurtful thing was, and this in the book, is the sports writers, you know, writing about me that, you know, they should take my scholarship. I'm a bust. I came from a small A school, the 2A school, and Craig's a better player. And they say it wasn't nothing against him, but, you know, of course, you know, he's white, I'm black, and, you know, in Highland Park, they want him to succeed. They didn't really want me to succeed. And, you know, in the end, you know, really both of us succeeded.
Yeah, I was saying Craig was a 1,000-yard rusher in the NFL and had a very successful broadcasting career. So, like, it did work out. I agree with you, like, in that way when it all played out. Now, one thing I think is interesting, before we even knew we were doing this, I was looking up the SMU stuff. And when the NCAA came down, And when people talk about the slush fund, what jumped off the page to me was the amount of money that was listed for the slush fund was $60,000, which is not a gigantic amount of money. Like, even controlling for inflation, like, the word slush fund sounds like one thing, but $60,000, you're like, damn, that ain't even necessarily that much money. Now you and some of your former teammates are contributing $1 million, you know, toward NIL for players who might go to SMU. So, like, what do you think when you hear the way that people talk about the SMU days? Because I've always wondered, like, was it really as much money going around as people thought it was, or was just the idea so scandalous that any money? Because a whole lot of people's careers were ruined over $200 with the NCAA.
You said the key word. It was scandalous over any amount of money. It could have been $5. You know, oh, that's $5 too much, you know, to pay those guys. That's what it was. I mean, when you read my book, you see, I mean, I didn't get any money. I got $1,000 a month. And it wasn't even always $1,000. Sometimes it was $500. I mean, that's what it was. And that money, I'm trying to send back to help my mother, you know, because my dad had died. So I'm trying to help my mom. You know, you think about a thing now with, it's NIL. I think it's a great thing. I really do. Because, you know, in college, a lot of these kids, they can't afford to take girls on dates. They can't afford anything. I mean, because a lot of them are raised by grandma, single mom, maybe even a single dad. And they play for these universities that make all the money. The NCAA makes all the money. And why come they can't? Because they're the guys that's just doing the work. It's not it's black and white, but we know most of them are black kids. And the thing is that, you know, when you go to college, a lot of these kids don't go to college to graduate. They go to college to play football. They think they're going to play pro football. And that is a very small number. So for me, I like the idea of, they want to call it paying the players, call it what you want. I've always felt it was right. And going back to, like you said, a $60,000 an hour slush fund, it wasn't a lot of money being spent. But, you know, we were so good and guys wanted to play together. And, you know the big thing for kids, for us back in those days, was getting a car. 18, 19 years old, getting a car. Man, I got a new car. You know, I got a Pontiac Trans Am. We got a Corvette. That was the big thing. It wasn't about the money, it was the car.
Now, let me ask you this. I said that it seemed like you were ready for Dallas, and you said outwardly maybe. Were you ready for L.A.?
Yeah, I think I was ready for L.A., you know, because I came to L.A. on my recruiting trip. I'll never forget that when I came on my recruiting trip. And, you know, I was way different. The first time I saw it, because, being from Texas, I'd never been west. Well, I take that back. I went to Portland, Oregon with my mom on a train, you know. But L.A. was different because you think of L.A. as Hollywood, you know, that was Soul Train back in the time. You know, it was Clint Eastwood. It was John Wayne. It was Hollywood. So for me, when I saw the mountains and stuff, I'm like, man, it's beautiful. When I first came to California, and my first encounter really with, I say, a star was Magic Johnson at Venice Beach. And I'll never forget when Magic Johnson met some guys, and I said, I want to be like that guy. You know, I want to be like him. You know, people know who he is because, you know, he was just big as light in Los Angeles. I got to say, man, you know, playing for the Rams, even though we were in Anaheim, not in L.A., and we were in Anaheim, people kind of forget that. I became a big star, you know, very quickly. And it didn't change me. I got to say that one thing. It did not change me at all. I was still that country boy from Sealy, Texas. But did I enjoy the limelight? I enjoyed it while I had it, for sure.
Well, you talk about Anaheim in your book, and I think you may have had a similar thing that I had. So I went to graduate school out there, and I moved out there on 2 weeks' notice. I went to Claremont Graduate University, and I thought I was going to L.A.
Just like me.
Yeah, it was not. It was not, except Claremont compared to, like, the Orange County situation. And Claremont's not exactly the most progressive place in the world, but it was still L.A. County. I can imagine for you getting to Anaheim and being like, this is kind of like L.A., sort of.
You know, when I flew in, up to LAX. Ray San Jose picked me up, and we were driving. And because I went to visit SC, so I knew, not knew it, but I, you know, kind of knew, like, you know, the area a little bit, like, you know, this is Los Angeles. And I'm driving, and I'm seeing, like, the city behind me. I'm like, I said, L.A.'s back here, isn't it? He said, yeah. He said, we're in Anaheim. I said, what's Anaheim? He said, well, it's Orange County. I'm like, oh, okay. So I had no clue. So when we got out there, I'm like, well, this is kind of small. I won't forget all the orange groves, orange trees on the side of the freeway, you know, down to 405. But it was different. You know, I called Orange County back then. It was considered the only, we called the Orange Curtain. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of blacks didn't go out there. But, you know, like I said, very different out in Orange County.
Yeah, because race is a thing that you talk about a bit in your book. And I'm curious for you, just kind of as you go from different places. So you start in a small town and people have all the assumptions about what a small town is. And you think that every place is going to be different. And then you go to Dallas, which has its own sort of legacy of things. And then you go to L.A. and L.A.'s got its own but Orange County is a different animal than LA is when it comes to that. So I wonder, like, for you, especially as somebody of, you know, of a different era, just like what it was like for you to get around and kind of realize that, you know, this racism kind of follows us everywhere we go.
Well, you know, growing up in Texas, you know, I've seen it my whole life, you know, even in Dallas, sometimes you see it. Like my mother said in my book, it's different for you, son. It's always different for you. And, you know, I didn't believe that at first, you know, because, you know, I just thought everything was equal playing ground. You know, as a kid, I thought that. Just like when I talk about the first time I really saw it was when I tried out for Little League Baseball. And, you know, I was a good baseball player. And they put me on minor league instead of Little League. And I'm like, but it wasn't fair. And she said, Eric, I tried to tell you this. It's not the same for you. But, yeah, I mean, I've seen it in all steps, you know, going from Sealy to Dallas to L.A., or to Orange County, really, Orange County. And I can tell you, as you know as well as I do, Orange County and L.A. is way different from one another. I mean, I love coming to L.A. That's why eventually I ended up moving from Orange County. I lived in Irvine. I moved from Irvine, you know, to where I live now. I still live in Calabasas. And, you know, I just like being at that L.A. scene back then. You know, it was more to do. You know, you see more people like me, of us, like people of color, Hispanic, Black. I mean, I'm like, oh, I like this. So I just really enjoyed the whole scene. I think the big thing was, you know, it was just so diverse, you know, the diversity, you know, back in the 80s, man, you know, L.A. was, you know, banging. It was the place to be.
And then they sent you to Indianapolis.
Then they sent me to the hellhole.
Like, what was your first impression getting there?
I'll never forget when I left L.A. on the flight that night. You know, I watched, you know, took off and I saw all of the, like, this was like a sea of lights, you know, leaving Los Angeles. And I fell asleep. And when I woke up, they said, you know, we're landing in Indianapolis, you know, buckle up your seatbelt, blah, blah, blah. And I looked out and all I could see was darkness. I could see just cornfields everywhere. And I'm like, wow, what the hell, man? It was really different. I mean, I got to say, it wasn't even anything like Texas. Not even where I'm from in Texas. It was just really different, really country. I got to say, just a shock. But, you know, my coach, Ron Meyer, you know, I got to say, he took care of me as well as he possibly could while he was there.
How many jokes did you hear about how Ron Meyer had to pay you less to play for the Colts than they had to pay you to play for SMU?
Oh, you said it. All the jokes. Man, you took less money when you got in the NFL. Did you got like money? I'm like, please, man. I wasn't making no money in college. I've said that so many times. I wasn't making no money in college. I mean, people think I'm making all that. I wasn't making no money. I was glad to go to SMU because I think it was this place that my mother chose for me. She wanted me to go there. I never forget her statement because I wanted to go to OU. That's why I wanted to go to college. I mean, badly. She didn't like, well, she just said, I don't trust Barry Switzer. She said, I don't trust that man. He's a liar, Eric. I don't trust him. And so going to SMU, she liked Ron. She liked me, the idea of me staying in Texas. And she said, Eric, she said, look, she said, they've got their guys at Oklahoma and USC. She said, go to a school like SMU. You, she said, you and that, what's the kid and Craig? She said, you can start something. They'll be talking about y'all forever. And I got to say, man, she was right about that.
I still can't believe the A&M because Sealy is very much Aggie country. I can't believe that they did not find a way.
They tried. I mean, let me tell you, A&M tried desperately. You know why I didn't go to A&M? There was two reasons I didn't go to A&M. I thought it was a great school. I did not. And that, once again, being 18 years old, I did not like their uniforms. I did not like the colors of their uniform. And they had those yell leaders, not cheerleaders. We wanted some girls. And that was my two main reasons. I said, I just can't go to a school like this.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you made the right call. I went to school in Aggie country too, but you couldn't pay me enough to go over there. Like every time they wind up getting a recruit, I'm like, did you even visit?
See, and I visited because it was only an 80-mile drive down there.
Right, right. So post-career, like, what do you think is the biggest thing that you picked up on after football was done?
I think the biggest thing that you realize is that I'm still a young man. Now, what do I do? I think that's the big thing. You know, what am I equipped to do right now after playing football for all those years? And it's kind of scary in a sense. I mean, because you've always kind of had structure in your life, you know, like a structure, even though I'm kind of pretty much a structured person anyway. But you really did. I mean, you had a facility to go to. You had this to take. They take care of that, this for you. And now you kind of have to do it all on your own. And most guys aren't prepared for it, I got to say. And, you know, I think football is a sport that when it comes to the end, it comes, sometimes it can come just very, very abruptly, like hitting a brick wall. Like you will be going 100 miles an hour and bam, okay, boom, it's over. you know, you're not playing anymore for whatever injury, pretty much injury, or you, sometimes getting old. Pretty much, if you're a great player, a player that's played for many years, it stops sometimes slowly. But if it's an injury, it stops abruptly. And like mine was kind of an injury, I wasn't sure about. But in a sense, man, I had no real clue what to do at first for a while. Not even recreational, because a lot of guys I knew were still playing. I'm like, man, what the hell am I going to do? I mean, you know, you wake up, like, what am I going to do today? You know, if you watch some football, you know, when football season come around, did I miss it? Yeah, I missed some of it. I did. But as time went on, I was glad I wasn't playing.
Last thing I want to ask you before we go. Can you name anybody else that managed to take a Jerry Curl and prescription goggles and, like, legitimately make it work? Like, when people think about this, like, Eric Dickerson had the coolest look at any running back we can think of, and it was really with, like, the equivalent of Coke bottle, I can't see glasses, and a Jerry Curl.
That's a great question, man. People say it all the time. No, not really. And I couldn't see. I still can't see. I wear these glasses are for real. It was just a look I had. It was a look I had with the neck roll, the Jerry Curl, the goggles, the mouthpiece. You know, I always feel that if you look good, you play good. You know, and I thought I looked good on the field.
And you know what? When you really think about it, it was a real Black LA kind of look too. Like, when you realize that all them Black folks from LA, like, especially at that time, and just a few years removed from Arkansas, from Texas, and all those places, like, you look like those dudes.
Everybody had a Jerry Curl. I mean, right. You know, your uncle had a Jerry Curl. Everybody had a Jerry Curl. So that wasn't anything foreign, you know, when I got to LA. It was like, hey, you know, we called the curls for the girls. And mine was not all greasy. Greasy Jerry Curl. I had to put the stuff on all the time. One time I had to activate on, you know, you wash your hair after the game. You know, you put the activator, you know, get it all curly.
I love hearing y'all go back and talk about the work that y'all put in on those Jerry Curls, right? Like, we got jokes, and you're like, nah, you don't understand.
Jerry Curl, the thing about, I look at the guys today that wear these dreadlocks. I'm like, okay. Now, at least the Jerry Curl was out real hair. The dreadlock, guys, these guys' hair ain't growing down the back. I mean, they all look like the Predator.
Now, it is a lot of dudes that's cheating. Like, I forget which dude it was. It may have been Ray Buchanan, where I looked up, and I was like, you didn't have none of this hair last year, and now you got dreadlocks down to your back.
that's the thing.
We don't believe you. You need more people. All right, but look, Watch My Smoke. That's Eric Dickerson's new book. Check that out. Highly recommend that you get into it. He gets into a lot. My man, thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming on with us.
My man, thank you, man. I appreciate it.
All right, no problem. And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this 3 times a week. Gabe Bassain and Adi Khan handling things behind the scenes. Thank you, gentlemen. Remember, follow The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or follow on the ESPN app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.